Hi, Tommy. How you doing?
Hi, good. All right. How are you?
Okay. You didn't sound too good there. I wondered whether you have you is it another Ebola
No Ebola today, luckily.
Okay, that's good. Hang on, I'm just going to go and grab a glass of water because I know I'm going to start choking up in the middle of this. Just
Yeah,
a
you want to be hydrated.
Exactly. I completely missed the irony of that. I'll be back in a second.
All right.
Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly, and today I'm joined by Dr. Tommy Wood. Hi, Tommy.
Hi.
Tommy, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself? I know you've been on our podcast once before, and then also twice before on the Paleo Baby podcast. So, if you haven't discovered the Paleo Baby podcast yet, head over to iTunes and just search for Paleo Baby, and you'll find us right away. And Tommy gave us a fantastic discussion and research-led thinking for a number of really interesting topics if you have kids. So things like vaccines and cot death, all sorts of really controversial and interesting stuff. So check that out, the Paleo Baby podcast. But today we're going to talk about hydration. And sorry, that's a kind of roundabout way of asking you to just introduce yourself, Tommy, please.
Yeah, sure. So I guess the interesting things about me start with I have a degree in biochemistry first, and then I went to medical school at Oxford. I graduated a couple of years ago. At the moment, I'm doing a PhD in neonatal or baby brain metabolism. So that kind of leads on to the stuff we talked about on your other podcast. But throughout my time at university, I rode at both Oxford and Cambridge. And that was kind of my first foray really into exercise, having been quite sedentary as a kid. But then from there, I started to do more coaching and reading. And, after a while, I did a lot of sort of endurance type races, ultra marathons and things like that. So I've done the whole sort of gamut of different types of exercise and sort of coach athletes through that. And I do some sort of coaching and advising in my spare time from my PhD on various different things. So that's kind of like a potted history of what I've been up to.
You're quite a unique individual for that. I think a lot of people listening won't know that, not only are Oxford and Cambridge the most prestigious academic institutions in the UK, they also are, world famous for their rowing. And it's an extremely famous boat race that even I still know when it is, like each year.
Yeah,
That's super cool.
I was never that good. So I did train with the as sort of like a development squad at both universities. But if you sort of, I turned up with almost no exercise experience, real exercise experience. I'd done a couple of half marathons or something in when I was about 18. But if you turn up and then all the other guys who row Oxford and Cambridge, most of them come. They've come from Olympic boats, so these are like world class athletes. So I was kind of given a go because I was big and fairly strong, but I barely knew how to put my oar in the water compared to those guys. So I gave it a good go. It was great to, I sat in a boat with, Olympic athletes, which is a huge honor, but they probably wondered what on earth I was doing.
That's interesting and funny. But yeah, today I wanted to talk to you about hydration. And as always, the topic of conversation is led by my own personal interest, which is somewhat selfish, but I'm hoping that, we just mentioned this before we came on air that if I reach out to enough people, then I'm sure that some others are having the same sort of concerns or noticing the same things. And so specifically with hydration, I guess this is quite topical now, certainly in California. I'm looking out the window right now and it's beautiful sunshine and it's definitely warming up. It's probably going to be quite warm today. And the winter is long since gone and it's getting hot and the bike races have started. And so hydration is definitely something that's going to be on everybody's mind. And probably the rest of the world or some parts of the US are thinking you should die right now because they're still under snow. But yeah, no, that's kind of how it is. And I believe it's even nice weather in the UK as well as at the moment. So I think our timing is good with this one. So I'll tell you why I got interested in this. Back when I first started bike racing and I was a little bit clueless and I thought everything was about making the bike as light as possible. So that's what I did in mountain biking, which is not very useful. But the one thing I couldn't really make any lighter was the amount of water that I carried. You know, I was sure from what I'd been told and read around the internet or wherever else I'd heard this information that hydration was critically important. And there's no way that you should ever attempt to, you know, even go out and train without having, you know, enough fluid. And enough fluid wasn't as much as you might guess it would be. It was like some rule, like you had to hydrate a certain amount per hour.
Yeah.
And so I found myself, you know, doing these bike races and training as well, riding around with this enormous camelback on my back, which had contained, you know, 6% carbohydrate solution with, you know, maltodextrin in it or something. And, you know, it was a huge disadvantage, not only having that camelback on my back sort of covered an area that then couldn't, you know, let the heat escape, but also, you know, some of my races, they start with an enormous climb, like a 3,000 foot climb. So if you're going to carry 2 liters or even more of water or fluid up, you know, that sort of climb, that's quite a lot of extra energy or power to just to shift that weight. So,
yeah.
You know, there's that concern too. But so what happened was, as I switched to a lower carbohydrate, high fat diet, I noticed that I became less and less thirsty. And then there was one switch in particular that really was a pivotal moment. And that was switching to a product called Yukan Superstarch. And Yukan Superstarch is a very slow release carbohydrate source that claims not to spike insulin in quite the same way as a simple carbohydrate would. And I noticed an immediate change in my thirst. Like I just wasn't really thirsty at all. And I'm not the only one to notice this. I've spoken to several other people and they've said exactly the same thing. And, you know, I just kind of from there, I got more into reading, you know, like Tim Noakes's work, who's written a brilliant book, which I will link to. And I've totally forgotten the name of it. It's called Waterlogged.
Waterlogged.
That's it. And, you know, he talks about the problem of overhydration in endurance exercise. And, you know, that really got me thinking. And now I'm sort of wondering, is the whole world wrong apart from Tim Noakes and a handful of other people? And
that seems to be the case on a number of topics.
So. I know. Yeah, he keeps. But I mean, to be fair, he has done kind of at least one spectacular U-turn with the carbohydrates himself. So, yeah, I guess, you know, anybody can be wrong. But yeah, so tell me what you think about this stuff then. Do you think, I guess, you know, the history, I think, is relevant, right? So in back in the day, and Tim Noakes covers this in his book, that people used to do marathons and, you know, they wouldn't really carry any fluid at all. Like they would just do it and they'd get dehydrated and then they would drink and then would rehydrate. And, you know, that seems to be the way that humans were designed to work. And, you know, we kind of deviated from that. And it's not clear that that was the right decision. What do you think? Do you think people should just follow their thirst?
Yeah, I think that's kind of where we're coming to now. Like you say, back in the, you know, maybe 100 years ago, 60 years ago, up until about World War II, people sort of said, you know, during bike races, marathons, that, you know, in the Tour de France, it was considered ungentlemanly to drink too much water because it was a sign of weakness. And it was the same in marathons. You know, they encourage people not really to drink during marathon running. And then you kind of, in the 60s, you had the development of Gatorade by Robert Cade at the University of Florida because he felt that, I think he did one study where he made people sort of walk and run for around 7 miles and saw that if he gave them a carbohydrate drink that kind of their performance would improve, and he thought that that would be particularly relevant to football players in the final quarter of a football game. Mm-hmm. And then some people did some studies in marathon runners in the late 60s, and they found that people who lost more than 3% of body weight or more than 2 kilos had an increase in core temperature after at the end of a marathon, and at that point they assumed that was a bad thing. And I think that we can come back to the measures that people use in these studies and whether they're actually useful or not. But then the thing that Tim Noakes really talks about as sort of like the dangers of overhydration particularly points to this period in US military history back in the 80s where they adopted something called water as a tactical weapon, which is basically we were going to be so on top of hydration that we sort of drink ahead of thirst and make sure you're overhydrated. So almost. So these guys were drinking maybe almost half a gallon of water per hour.
Oh my God.
And then what happened is during a 10-year period, I think it was five or six guys died from something called hyponatremia, which basically is too little salt in the blood, too little sodium in the blood. And this actually has become, you know, and there was a famous case in the early 2000s of somebody who died in the Boston Marathon. And it's literally just from drinking too much water, the sodium in the blood goes too low. And to start with, you get things like changes in cognition or changes in mood, and then eventually you can have seizures. And if you get really bad, the brain will swell so much. That's essentially what happens. The brain swells so much that it sort of pushes itself down, tries to push itself down through the bottom of your skull, then you basically end up, you know, and it kills you. So that's kind of where the real danger from overhydration comes from. He references a guy called Bernd Heinrich, who is a biology professor emeritus at the University of Vermont, who talks about the fact that, you know, we as a species evolved on the plains of Africa, right? And we spent many hours a day hunting, and we are uniquely adapted to actually become dehydrated, voluntarily dehydrated, you know, and so choose to not drink because it may affect our ability to hunt and then catch up later. And we sweat, which almost no other animals do. So it means that we can regulate our body temperature very easily in another way. And there are many tribes in Africa that will hunt, you know, 20 miles, say, in a day in the middle of the day while all the other predators are hiding in the sun or hiding in the shade. They can go out and hunt prey, and they won't take any water with them. So, you know, we have the ability to become dehydrated and still perform at a fairly good level. And there are lots of studies now coming out that we can talk about that sort of suggest this. And it really seems to be that if we drink just to thirst, both in studies and just from day to day, you know, people going about their daily activities or daily exercise, then that absolutely seems to be enough to keep us hydrated and healthy. Mm-hmm. So there doesn't really, even though if you exercise and you become dehydrated or you lose a certain amount of body water, for instance, I sweat a lot. I can easily lose 2 or 3 kilos in an hour if I'm doing some kind of marathon in the heat. But if you drink to thirst, you won't completely compensate. You won't drink your way all the way up back to your weight, but you'll get about maybe 50 or 60% of the way there. And in terms of performance, that seems to be enough.
Okay. Is it useful to talk about where thirst even comes from, like the sense of thirst even comes from in the first place? Can it be relied on?
So if you go back 20 or 30 years, they thought that it couldn't be relied on. And that's because when you're looking at studies of hydration and performance, so some of the first studies where they were looking at the amount, so what they first looked at was the amount of body weight you lost. And it was always assumed that whatever body weight you lost was water, right? So then if you just relied on thirst, you wouldn't drink yourself up, you know, to back to your normal body weight. So they thought that if you're looking at body weight as a function of how much water you lose, then obviously thirst isn't doing a good enough job because it's not getting you back up to that, okay, to that, you know, original point. And thirst basically comes from, so the interesting thing is that none of the things that they measure or adjust to in these studies are actually what the body regulates in terms of thirst and hydration. So they'll look at things like plasma volume, which is basically the volume of the blood minus the cells, or something like body weight. But what the body actually does is it looks at the total amount of stuff. So solute, and that's, you know, all the minerals and all the other things that your blood carries. And it looks at like the total concentration of those. So it's something called the plasma osmolality. And that's measured by the hypothalamus. Mm-hmm. And as that starts to go up, that means that all the stuff in your blood isn't diluted in as much water. So then that stimulates thirst. And that's quite tightly regulated. But when people have tried to, you know, dehydrate people and then see how they perform, they don't you know, they're not dehydrating by a certain amount of plasma osmolality and then seeing what happens. They're going for a surrogate measure that maybe isn't as useful, and they're making assumptions that then make the conclusions of what a study less relevant.
Okay, so I've got this quote here which I thought was interesting, and I think I got this from, let me just double check before I lampooned someone. Yeah, it's from the Osmo Nutrition website. And this quote comes from somebody, Dr. Sims, who I believe has a PhD of some type. So she's obviously a very smart woman. But let me see what you think about this. The science is simple. Hydration, which refers to the maintenance of water in your blood, is critical to maximizing power, endurance, and reducing fatigue. When you're thirsty, you've already lost 2% of your body water and 11% of your power. So 11%, that's far more than, you know, makes the difference between first and 10th place in any sort of elite event of any type I can think of. So it's huge. So if this woman's right, then, you know, that the hydration really is important. But she says the science is simple. So do you think, what does the evidence show? Is that true?
So actually, nowadays what they're saying is that as long as you sort of like the American College of Sports Medicine has like a mission or a position statement on hydration, and they say that as long as you drink to keep yourself above 2% of body weight, again, that's still the measure they're using, then you're probably okay, and that's enough. And actually what they've shown, and we've known for a long time, is that you can actually lose about 2% of your body weight and see no difference in performance. And there's about a 2% buffer there. So that what she's saying isn't actually correct, because once you might even need to go quite far below 2% before you actually start to see, you know, in the real, you know, in the well-performed studies, before you actually see a decrease in power, particularly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the best studies is one that we've discussed before, which is done a couple of years ago, where basically they took some scientists. Took some cyclists, and these cyclists were dehydrated by 3% of body weight, which is where they thought they'd see like a decrease in power or, you know, time trial speed. And they did that, so they get them to walk and cycle at a low kind of pace in 33 degrees, that's about 95 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that, for a couple of hours. And then what they did is they rehydrated them intravenously, so they gave them like a saline solution into the blood, but they were blinded, so they didn't know how much of their body weight they were getting back. So they were dehydrated by 3%, and then they were either kept at 3%, taken up to 2% dehydrated by body weight, or, you know, filled back all the way. And what they actually found is that between those three treatments, there was no difference in performance. And so what that sort of points to is all the problems that we've had in other studies of hydration. So things they did, you know, like the average or the old studies looking at dehydration and performance, you dehydrate the person initially, which obviously isn't something that the average athlete or any elite athlete would do, right? You'd start in a hydrated state, and then you might become dehydrated during the event, but you'd never start in a dehydrated position.
Mm-hmm.
And they do something that might give you some diuretics, so some drugs that make you pee out extra fluid, or they'll make you exercise first. But if you exercise first, then obviously you've lost glycogen. So then you have, you know, less energy reserve for the exercise you're about to do. So that's going to affect your performance as well. And they're usually done inside, so there's no wind or anything like that. But the most important thing is if you've spent however long it is now, 50 years telling people that being dehydrated is going to affect their performance, mm-hmm. and then these athletes or just average people or elite athletes are in the lab being tested and they know they've been dehydrated already, immediately they're going to think, I'm thirsty, I'm tired, I'm dehydrated, I'm supposed to perform worse because I know I perform worse when I'm dehydrated. And already you've biased the study.
Right. And I wonder whether I've seen the opposite of this. You know, after I read Waterlogged, you know, I kind of changed my behavior based on my respect for Tim Noakes. And, it's not clear to me whether I was never thirsty in the first place or whether I became less thirsty after reading the book.
So, I have a few theories about, because you've sort of become keto and fat adapted, and I have some theories about why that might reduce the amount of water or it might reduce your thirst, which we're going to talk about later.
Right.
What I was going to say is that what potentially one of the things that might have happened over the last few years is you've become a better cyclist. So
right.
We know that in elite athletes, they tolerate dehydration much better and they tolerate thirst much better, and thirst doesn't have as much of an effect on their performance. Because, I mean, when you're thirsty, it's very difficult to think about anything else. But if you're used to that and you've trained in that position, so, you know, there's a study of Kenyan runners that was run by Tim Noakes's team, which showed that, you know, when they're running and training, they don't really drink anything. So they're kind of used to dehydrating themselves and then rehydrating later. And so elite athletes tolerate dehydration better. But also, if you take somebody who's even not an elite athlete and you get them used to the protocol of dehydration, so they, you know, there was one study which was done, I think it was just last year, and they dehydrated people by getting them to run for 45 minutes and then do a 5-kilometer time trial on the treadmill. And, you know, if they were just dehydrated, then in the time trial, they were about 70-something seconds slower than they would have been if they were properly hydrated. But if they did the time trial having gone through the dehydration protocol 4 times already, so they were used to the feeling of being dehydrated, then there was no decrease in their performance. So there's a huge sort of cognitive part of it as well. So if you're used to the dehydration and your body is acclimated to it, then actually that might be part of the reason why you see less of an issue, is the fact that you're kind of, your body is used to working in that state. And then obviously, you know, if you get to carry less water and then you move faster and there's the, you know, you feel better because you've got better performance, and, you know, all that stuff can feed into it as well.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And you can see this, you know, when I ride with Julie, who doesn't ride very much. And, you know, I think another thing that comes into this is the ability to sweat, which I understand is actually trainable. So as you know, get used to being hot and maybe performing, doing exercise in the heat, then your ability to lose heat through sweating gets better. And so Judy has almost, you know, no ability. I'm sure there's a genetic component to this too, but she has almost no ability to sweat at all. So when she gets hot, she just gets really flustered and almost slightly panicky, you know, kind of, you can, if you look really closely, you can just see tiny little beads of sweat on her forehead, but basically she's not sweating at all. Whereas I don't think of myself as a sweaty person, but, you know, if you put me in the sauna for 10 minutes, like, I'll literally, you know, it's like water is pouring out of me from somewhere. It's like, and I'm sure, you know, I wasn't like that before I started training. This is something I've acquired, but it all amounts to this kind of just a stress signal that's, you know, coming to some unconscious part of the brain. So Judy's just thinking, I'm hot, I'm exhausted, I can't breathe very well, like, make this stop, give me that water, I need to cool down. And it's something that, you know, we associate with cooling down and maybe removing some sort of stressor. So to have that, you know, like, removed from you forcibly, you know, no, you can't have any water, is just going to make the situation worse.
No, absolutely. And it's meant to, you know, it's meant to be like that. You know, if you're, so say, you know, we go back to the sort of evolutionary perspective, and you've been out hunting and running in the heat, and you suddenly become exceptionally thirsty, what that's going to do is it's going to force you to slow down and conserve energy until you manage to find some water, and then you can continue again. Right. So it's thirst is that kind of driver to, and the discomfort from it is the driver to kind of, it's like a self-preservation thing. Right. So, I mean, that's exactly why it's developed. And absolutely, the more people train, the more they seem to sweat. But an interesting thing, I think, is that what they've seen in a number of studies, particularly in like long endurance, so marathon, ultramarathon, Ironman type races, the people who finish fastest tend to finish with the highest body temperature and the most level of dehydration. So, you know, they'll lose almost 10% of their body weight. And a lot of that isn't water. A lot of that is burned glycogen. Then you lose water associated with that. Or if you want it, you can gain water and it comes into your circulation. But these people, if you increase your core temperature, then that allows you to offload more temperature without sweating. So you just increase the gradient to the environment. So actually by running faster, and it's actually just the running faster which increases your metabolism, which increases your temperature, or running or swimming or whatever, then actually if you get used to that and you adapt to it, then actually you'll offload more heat that way without sort of on the side of sweating as well. So that's kind of in trained people, that's another adaptive mechanism that allows them to offload heat and preserve water if they need to, but again, they're much better at dealing with that level of dehydration.
Okay, I understand. And you know, I wanted to get into, so where does the sugar thing fit into all this? Like that interests me. It seems like sugar stimulates my thirst. Like I've noticed this now. I did a bike race, I think it was late last year. And I was feeling terrible. I think there was just something else wrong with me. I don't know what it was. I was having a really bad race. And I thought, you know, maybe I should just take some sugar, like this high fat ketogenic thing. Maybe it just doesn't work for these, you know, let's just do the sugar. Like there's an aid station every 10 miles. And of course it's stocked up to the nines with all the different types of gel. And I just thought, all right, screw it. I'm going to take one. And all it really did was make me thirsty. I still felt awful. It made me really thirsty, which really sucked.
Yeah, I mean, so this is another point that I kind of had, was that all these studies, you know, particularly looking at the sports drinks and you know, a lot of these studies that have come out over the years, and, you know, we're sort of the stuff that I'm talking about is the stuff that's kind of on the fringes, because you can go out and you can find hundreds of studies showing that this amount of carbohydrate plus this amount of salt will increase performance this much. And guess what? That's, you know, Powerade or Lucozade if you're in the UK. Mm-hmm. But you know, all these studies are done in carbohydrate-adapted athletes. So mm-hmm. this is something they're used to, and they're used to, you know, using up that amount of glucose. And so then I think applying that to a keto or fat-adapted athlete in terms of requirements for both electrolytes and energy is probably not that relevant and might actually, sort of be something completely different. But what I would think is that if you have, so the problem is if you're generally fat adapted, you become peripherally, you know, like your body and your muscles in general become more insulin resistant, mm-hmm. Right? So that saves the glucose that you do have for the brain. And obviously, when you're exercising, you have some non-insulin dependent glucose uptake into muscles. So mm-hmm. that kind of bypasses the system, but you'll still, you know, get less glucose into the muscles than you would otherwise.
Let me stop you right there. Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. How do you know this for sure? It's kind of something that's almost interesting to me. I mean, it makes perfect sense what you've just said, that, you know, your brain would try and preserve glucose for itself. But I'm not sure I've really seen any really good evidence that shows that that's true. And I recently listened to, I don't know if you listened to it, but it was Peter Attia talking on Tim Ferriss's podcast. I think it's episode number 65. It's the second one he did, mm-hmm. where he talked about going into seeing some guy at Stanford, and they did some sort of weird glycemic clamp on him, where they basically injected glucose and then enough insulin to cover it. In the hope of trying to measure how sensitive to insulin he was in this state of ketosis. And I think I'm getting this right, repeating this correctly, but what they found was he was incredibly sensitive to insulin, and the amount of insulin they gave him to cover the glucose that was going in was actually far too much. And he ended up nearly, you know, going into a coma. It was a really, really ugly ending. And, you know, he gave that one example, and then he gave another example where what you said was exactly true. Like somebody failed an oral glucose tolerance test and therefore was unable to donate a kidney to their brother. Kind of a crazy story. But, you know, his advice, Peter Attia's advice to the guy was just eat some carbs for a week and try the test again. And sure enough, it was fine. So I've kind of both sides of the evidence, both for and again, even though it's anecdotal. But have you seen something that shows this is true for most people?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm certain that it's very individual, and the problem is that one, it's very difficult to measure insulin resistance, and doing something like a euglycemic or a euglycemic clamp, where you try and keep glucose the same and see how much insulin you need given however much glucose to try and clear it. And so there's not many studies where they've done a lot of that in a lot of people because it's difficult to do. But you know, there are studies where they're mainly done in the metabolically deranged. And I guess that's part of a confounder, is these people have type 2 diabetes or obesity, mm-hmm. and they've been put on, and it's usually maybe 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a little bit longer, of a low carb, high fat diet. And then you do an oral glucose tolerance test, which is obviously less sensitive. And what you see is that glucose goes, sky high, and then it takes a really long time to come down. Somebody like Peter Attia, I mean, he's a pretty big guy. So he's got, he's got a lot of muscle mass, which might, have maintained his insulin sensitivity. He does a lot of sort of high intensity exercise and weight training, as far as I remember, right?
So his hypothesis was that exactly that. I should say, I've sort of missed a part of the story there. Was his hypothesis is that exercise is the kind of the key factor here. And if you're in a constantly glycogen depleted state because you've been exercising without taking on any carbohydrates, then that might, stop you from entering into this peripheral insulin resistant state. Yeah. And it's certainly true for me. Like, obviously I haven't done the fancy, euglycemic clamp test at Stanford, but, I've had like literally 1 or 2 days since I went into ketosis probably 18 months ago, where I've eaten, screw it, I'm just eating the dessert. Let's just do this. And then I check my blood glucose, and 30 minutes later, an hour later, and it goes up into the 90s. And then, the next morning, like my fasted glucose is 85 again. So there's like no real, I mean, I guess like what's happening with your blood glucose doesn't really tell you how insulin resistant you are. Yeah, but, it certainly didn't do anything crazy like you might expect.
Your body will always find a way to clear it. It's sort of, but it's not to do with like how high it goes, or it's how long it takes to clear it and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But maybe, so say you're in a race and you have a load of glucose, and actually, you're not necessarily that insulin resistant, and you've been exercising all your muscles, so you have a load of non-insulin dependent mm-hmm. glucose uptake anyway into the muscles. But what will happen is insulin will go up, and very transiently your serum osmolality will go up, because all that glucose will hit your system and act as like a solute in your blood until it's cleared, however long that takes. So I think the combination of those two things, because insulin causes you obviously to retain more sodium, so your sodium will increase transiently, your glucose will increase transiently, and that in the sort of medium to short term, maybe over however long it was, 10, 20 minutes, half an hour, that will, I think that's probably what made you more thirsty.
Okay. And so you've just kind of like something, the penny's just dropped here. So this happens in kind of the late stages of diabetes, right? Like if someone gets really, really thirsty, and that's what's happening there. There's so much glucose, so much solute in the blood, like your brain thinks you're really dehydrated and makes you really thirsty.
Well, it's partly that, but it's also, so that's absolutely it. So your osmolality has gone up, and that makes you thirsty. But it's also the fact that what happens is your blood glucose goes up so high that you basically overwhelm your kidney's ability to reabsorb glucose. So what happens in the kidney is sort of basically everything goes through a basic filter, and all the small stuff, which is usually like amino acids and glucose and sodium and all that stuff, is reabsorbed later on. And then what's not reabsorbed is peed out. But the kidney can only reabsorb so much glucose. So if you've got more glucose than that in the blood, that will you'll pee that out. But what it will also do is it will draw fluid out. So it will basically, it acts as a diuretic, and that's, so those people pee a lot more as well.
Okay. Yeah, so I talked to this guy. He phoned me up for a consultation, and that was how he found out that he had diabetes. Was he was just out on a hike one. I mean, he knew that he'd always been kind of weirdly thirsty. And he was drinking at that time a gallon of orange juice per day. And yeah, he was out on a hike one day and he just got overwhelmed with thirst and ended up drinking out of dirty puddles, like, because he was just so thirsty. And he went to the emergency room afterwards, and that's when they found out. But yeah, scary stuff. So I get something to a sort of lesser degree is happening then when you take on sugar. So are these people crooks then? You know, I want to go back to what that woman just said. It's like, okay, well, if I feed you this sugar, then you'll also need my drink. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's the ice cream salesman on a hot day. It's almost like the ice cream salesman has somehow got the ability to manipulate the weather and make it really hot so everybody wants his ice cream.
Yeah. The I mean, obviously, there's a lot of in the people the groups of people that think that we should, you know, we don't necessarily need all these fancy drinks and we can just drink water to thirst, and, you know, maybe we need a small amount of electrolyte replacement, but probably not that much. There's always the conspiracy theory that the drinks conglomerates have kind of, you know, forced us in this direction. And obviously, like, all the advertising associated with that, and people, you know, loads of adverts, you know, and athletes saying that, you know, drink this to stop you getting dehydrated. So, I mean, there's certainly an element of that, but I also think that, at least up to a certain point, these people think that, you know, I like to think the best in people. So there's certainly an element where they are certain, based on the studies that they've read, and there are lots of studies which show that drinking whatever it is will make you run faster, or preventing dehydration will make you run faster. But obviously the problems, you've kind of mentioned all the problems with a lot of those studies. Mm-hmm. So they honestly think that they are, you know, helping people and reducing things like, you know, collapse and dehydration and helping people perform better. So I think there's kind of a bit of both.
Okay. And then what do you think about the recommendation for electrolytes? You know, I've had quite a few people saying to me, well, you know, it's okay for you to just drink plain water, but you've got to get your electrolytes. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of tricky to give sort of broad spectrum recommendations, because it really depends on how much you sweat and the kind of person you are, you know, how much solute or how, you know, the minerals that you'll lose. So, you know, most people, your sweat is mostly water, and you will lose more water compared to the amount of salt that you lose, say, from your sweat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the concentration of the blood tends to go up, because you preferentially lose water. But they've shown, in terms of rehydrating people, they've shown that, you know, something like 2 to 6% glucose, and they have that as an energy source rather than as a rehydration source, because what happens is the glucose gets, so what you need in order to keep the fluid that you drink in the blood, you need to have something that will keep it in the vascular system, so in your blood vessels.
Right.
If I took you and I infused a load of water into your vein, most of that water would leave your blood and end up somewhere else. So it would probably, you'd probably end up with swollen feet or something like that, because the water, the concentration of the fluid that's outside the blood vessels is higher, and it will draw that water out of your blood vessels, out of your sort of plasma volume.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need is, you need to give something that will keep it there. Glucose is metabolized very quickly. So then once that glucose is metabolized, then again, you're left with just water, which will go somewhere else. So you need something like sodium, which will keep it in, you know, the sodium will get absorbed and you'll get more sodium inside the blood, and that will keep some of the water there, because water basically flows from where things are less concentrated to where they're more concentrated in terms of all the other stuff that's dissolved in the water. So, you know, even very dilute amounts of sodium. So like a saline solution that you give a patient to rehydrate them is 0.9% sodium chloride. So that's about, it's about 2 teaspoons of salt in a liter. But even something that's like a fifth of that, in terms of the amount of salt in a liter of water, that kind of concentration of salt seems to be enough to get people's to rehydrate them, compared to something like water. So you really don't actually need that much, if you see what I mean, to kind of just stay on top of your hydration. And again, Like if we go back to earlier, if you're somebody that trains a lot and, you know, it kind of gets used to it, then you can actually deal with a reasonable amount of loss of both water and some electrolytes in your sweat without any real problem.
So this is more about, you know, obviously some salt is lost in the sweat. So when you take on electrolytes with that fluid, this is not really about replacing the salt that's lost in the sweat. It's more about trying to make the fluid that you do take more effective to make it stick inside the cells. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, to make it stick inside, the blood.
Inside the blood.
Because if you drink just pure water, it will go everywhere, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Because when you exercise, more fluid goes to those, will naturally leave the blood and go to those muscles, because of, you know, the way they're exercising and the movement of the things like potassium and calcium inside and outside of the muscle. You need some more fluid there. So, you know, almost half of, you know, if you measure the plasma volume of somebody, when they've exercised to dehydrate themselves, most of that fluid will actually, it hasn't gone anywhere except for it's gone to the muscles, and then it will come back into the circulation. So when you measure the volume of the circulation of somebody, they've actually just redirected that fluid to the muscles, and then it will just come back when they don't need it for exercise anymore.
Oh, interesting. That is interesting.
So when these people look at plasma volume during exercise, they assume that, you know, plasma volume has dropped, which is a bad thing, but actually that plasma volume is just, that fluid has just gone where the body needs it. And once they stop exercising, it just comes right back into the blood.
That's really interesting.
So it's kind of a combination of replacing the salt and then replacing the salt you've lost, and also just having the salt go and stay in the blood, if you see what I mean, because the two kind of go together.
Okay. And then what conclusion do you make when you see someone that's a really salty sweater, right? So there definitely seems to be a difference between people. Like I get a little bit, you know, like on my helmet straps, there's just like a, you know, maybe a tiny bit of salt visible. But some people you see, like they finish a bike race. And maybe what I'm really noticing is the difference in color of people's spandex or something. Oh, yeah.
Those tide lines.
Exactly. Yeah, salt, it's crazy. Yeah. Like you see some people and you're like, holy cow, that's ridiculous. It's like literally crusting and like flaking off of them. And like, so what conclusion, if anything, do you make when you see that?
I mean, I don't really think that there's, I don't really think there's, as far as I've seen, and it might just be that I haven't seen any data on this, I don't really think that you can make that much of a, where there's much of a conclusion to be made there. And I think there's just some personal, just whatever your body needs to shift in order to get the kind of, you know, because all the body is trying to do is maintain homeostasis, which is basically keeping everything nice and regular. It doesn't like being out of its comfort zone in terms of physiological stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's basically whatever it needs to do in order to maintain that and keep you alive is what it does. So I'm not sure that somebody with, you know, a saltier lycra at the end of their bike race is, you know, if there's anything you can particularly get from that. Okay. But you can kind of, I mean, another thing, and again, this is one of Tim Noakes' things, and he's done studies on this looking at, you know, levels of salt in the blood and things like cramp. And they see that actually the amount of salt that you lose doesn't, although you will lose some, that doesn't really correlate with cramps or anything like that. So we're told that, you know, potassium or magnesium or sodium and whether you're dehydrated or not is associated with cramps during, you know, races, particularly, again, long races where you get dehydrated. And he's found that there's actually really no correlation between that and between the amount of soluble or minerals you lose and cramping either.
I'm so glad you brought this up because somebody would probably kill me if I didn't mention this because cramp, I'm really annoying, well, in a number of ways, but this is one of them. And that's, I don't know what cramp is. I've never experienced cramp. Like I've seen people cramp in a bike race. And so I have an idea of what they're going through, but I've never experienced it. And so I don't, you know, it's not something I think about a lot. And I probably wouldn't have asked you because of that. But yeah, of course, it's something that it's like, you know, bro science or conventional wisdom, whatever you want to call it, that cramping is somehow related to dehydration or electrolyte balance. So you think all that's not true then?
Well, I mean, just based on the, so I guess just based on, say, this is one particular study from Tim Noakes's guys. I mean, this was done about 10 years ago now. And they looked at cramp in people in like an ultra distance marathon. And in those that cramped, they had slightly lower sodium, but it was completely within the normal range. They had slightly higher magnesium, but again, completely in the normal range. Like potassium wasn't any different. And these are all the things that we're kind of told are associated with cramp. And actually, in the group of people that didn't cramp or didn't have any history of cramp, they actually at the end of the race, they had lost the concentration of their blood, their plasma osmolality had gone up more, and they'd lost more weight. So I assumed they were more dehydrated and they didn't get cramp. So there's actually, at least in that study, there was no association between any of those things and cramp. And that seems to be a very, you know, individual thing. And because, you know, if you have big changes in a number of any of those minerals, so magnesium, calcium, sodium, potassium, you can get sort of contractions of the muscles that you can't release because you need like the normal signaling for the muscles to release and relax. But that tends to happen, and this is the point they make in that paper, that tends to happen in all the muscles in the body or in large numbers of mm-hmm. muscles in the body. But what happens normally if you cramp, you usually cramp in one thing. So it's one calf or one quad or, you know, one tricep, depending on the exercise you're doing.
Right.
So for kind of those whole body changes in electrolytes to cause very localized cramping just actually seems like a bit of a strange leap of logic. And their data suggests that probably the two aren't connected.
Right. And I think I remember reading that in the book. They gave this example of, you know, people that are performing intricate work with their fingers, you know, they get cramp in their fingers, but they don't get cramp in their quad.
Yeah.
which makes a lot of sense. So yeah, sorry, I guess we don't really have any good answers for what causes cramp. No. It seems like it might be more related to fatigue and something particular about the effort involved in making a race pace, you know, length of time exercising, and then maybe bike fit as well might come into it, or running style, you know, or your gait, whatever it is in for your sport.
So what happens in muscles when they contract is you get some shifts in the electrolytes. So calcium is basically shuttled in and out, which is then calcium mm-hmm. is the thing which makes muscles contract. But potassium is also as the more you contract, potassium is normally inside cells, like all cells, and also in muscle cells. And eventually, from the repeated contraction, then potassium sort of leaks out, and it's not available there for normal contraction. So I think again, it's also going to be partly on what you've done with that muscle, how used that muscle is to doing that work, and it might be to do with very local changes in the minerals or electrolytes, but certainly not something that happens on like a whole, like it doesn't mean that you need to eat more bananas to replace your potassium, if you see what I mean.
Right.
And which is what people, you know, that's a very standard advice, isn't it?
Right, exactly, yeah. But that sodium potassium pump, it requires energy, right? So if the cells run out of energy, could it be possible that the balance would be maintained for that reason?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. If you're not getting the if your your muscle glycogen runs out, and you could definitely, you know, so your calf bonks by itself and runs out of muscle glycogen. Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, this has been a very fascinating and enlightening conversation, Tommy. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing all this. It's like, I know you did a ton of research to record this interview, so I'm really, really grateful for your time. Is there anything we missed? I'm probably going to like kill myself like the moment I hang up, like thinking there's something I missed.
So I did have some theories about why people who are fat adapted.
Oh, we totally forgot about that.
Are less thirsty, particularly during exercise, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that we talked about initially, or my first thought was that when you metabolize fat, you release water.
So right.
The water of metabolism.
And this is why I'm not thirsty.
Well, I don't, it might be part of it. So when, for every gram of fat you use, you release 1.2 grams of water, mm-hmm. roughly. And so in traditional, in sort of traditional athletes, you know, who are running on carbs and gels and all that kind of stuff, they burn about half a gram of fat per minute on average.
Right.
So that would give them, you know, 30 mils of water, something an hour, which isn't very much.
No.
But if you look at the Folek and Finney's a very recent study, which I don't think they've published yet, but we've seen some of the data on, you know, they've done online talks and stuff. And they seem in fat adapted endurance athletes, they get up to 2 grams of fat, almost 2 grams of fat per minute metabolized, which would then give you something like 120 mils of water per hour, which isn't that much. But it is some, and then you also get, one of the studies that they did, you know, Finney did 30 years ago now, they looked at keto-adapted cyclists, and they still have about 25% of normal glycogen burning. So they only lose, when you keto-adapt, you only lose about 25% of your glycogen, and then it sort of like stays in a steady state at about 75%. And you still use it, but again, you know, at an 80% lower rate. But when you burn glycogen, you release water because glycogen is stored with like three to four times its weight in water. So even somebody who's keto adapted, I did some calculations, you'll probably get, you know, 60 to 80 mils of water released from the glycogen that you burn, even though you're mainly burning fat. So that's like 200 mils an hour, which, again, isn't much, but, you know, it might be enough for somebody who doesn't sweat much or is, you know, you've got to a point where you're used to being dehydrated. And then your UCAN superstarch, you know, for every gram of carbohydrate you burn, you release another half a gram of water. So, I mean, again, we're not talking huge volumes of water, but that kind of stuff might be there to sort of keep you ticking over.
Mm-hmm.
And then an extra benefit I was thinking that you might get is that, again, your insulin levels are lower, so you'll retain less sodium. And as you fat adapt, your basal metabolic rate also drops. And so what I'm purely theorizing is that you have an increased buffer for the amount that you can derange your physiology and still stay within the normal range. So if your normal temperature has dropped a little bit because your metabolic rate has dropped because you fat adapted, then, you know, your body temperature can increase more than somebody who's carb adapted and still be within the normal range. And again, same for sodium levels. So your sodium, you know, people who have lower insulin levels are fat adapted, they tend to have lower sodium.
Okay.
Because their insulin levels are lower.
Well, wait, so you're saying my metabolic rate has dropped because I'm, you know, fat adapted or in ketosis. So how would I mean, because I've seen like maybe the opposite. So my temperature has actually increased since I started eating a ketogenic diet.
Yeah, so again, that's very variable, and that will just depend on how. But for most people, when they reduce carbohydrates in the diet, their you know, like thyroid hormones drop, which reduces the stimulation of something called uncoupling proteins in the mitochondria, which kind of drive part of our heat production.
Mm-hmm.
But again, some people talk about if you do a lot of things like cold thermogenesis, then you can upregulate your basal metabolic rate. So it could be that your metabolic rate has gone up. But for most people, it seems that metabolic rate decreases a little bit when they fat adapt. And that's not a bad thing. That's just like a normal physiological response. But I was thinking that potentially if your insulin levels are lower, then you have a bit of a buffer in terms of your sodium levels before you start to feel thirsty, if you see what I mean, because they start slightly lower.
And I
have no idea if that's true. That was just a thought that I had, trying to figure out why you were less thirsty when you eat it.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, I think all of this, the one thing that I'm starting to learn is that whenever you look at the the research studies, and it doesn't matter whether it's something that looks at exercise performance or whether it's a study that's nutrition science, is it hints at something that might be a solution. And, you know, sometimes the quality of the science is really shoddy and it's not a very good hint. And then, you know, sometimes it's much, much better. And for nutrition science, I just read an article in Slate magazine when the reporter was talking about this. And they'd obviously talked to Peter Attia again at NUSI and talked about, you know, his thoughts on trying to improve the quality of the nutrition science. But even then, like when it's really, really good, you still won't know how it applies to you. And really, the only thing you can do is your own experiment and take notice. Like, so, okay, so we've got this idea that when you get dehydrated, you're going to be slower on your bike. Well, you know, try and keep an open mind about either possibility, because we know that the placebo is going to come into play, or your beliefs are going to come into play here. And then just do your own experiment. And if you find that, you definitely are slower when you're even slightly dehydrated, then my advice would be to drink more. But, you know, just keep an open mind and know that just because you read something or on the front page of the Osmo website, it doesn't necessarily make it true.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent. Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And I know that you write and you have your own podcast. So tell me, how can people find out more of this good stuff that you offer to people?
My website is drragnar.com, so that's drragnar.com. Mm-hmm. Ragnar's my middle name if anybody's trying to figure out why on earth I've got that. But most of my stuff on there is kind of general health, but I also sort of like deconstruct studies and try and figure out and give sort of like a framework for people to figure out the best way to sort of eat themselves healthier. And it's just not about food, it's about so much other stuff. So that's all on there. And I run the Eat Better podcast, which, you know, you've been a guest on, Chris, and which everybody loves. So thanks for that. It's called Eat Better, and I run it with a girl called Chloe. She's from a website called Paleo Britain, and we do that together. And so all of that can be found on my website, and you can download the podcast in hundreds of different ways if you're
just there's like so many different ways now, it's impossible to keep up with them all. But obviously I'll link to this, and I would highly recommend it, especially for the people that you know, you're bored with the paleo chat. So I'm not sure if it's the most recent episode now, but the one I listened to on fish oil was fantastic. You know, it's like you go into so much detail and you've obviously put so much work into the preparation, and you know, I really learned a lot from that episode. And I can't say that's true of every single podcast that I listen to now. Like, sometimes I realize it's entertaining, but it's not really educational. Yeah. So you're definitely on, you know, the educational side of that spectrum, which I really, really appreciate. So yeah, keep that up. I will link to it. Thanks very much.
No problem.
Okay. Cheers then, Tommy.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.